Greetings, dear friends. There are landscapers directly outside of my office and barking dogs and helicopters, and some kind of basic chaos vortex has formed outside of my studio, so at least part of this intro is going to have to be recorded in a digital voice, because I want to get the intro done today, but as often happens when I set a goal, the universe is pushing back by creating a literal hurricane of insane noises. It's not just the landscapers, the dogs, my neighbor Jack hammering concrete, the toddler, or the very loud birds preventing the usual intro. It's that when there is a break in the sound, I get paranoid that at any moment the sound will start back up. So this intro, as unsatisfying as it may seem to those of you who love my deep, booming, central voice, is very satisfying to me in that it represents a kind of victory over the forces of chaos. This is the sort of thing that all of my favorite teachers have taught me regarding getting things done. That if you wait for the perfect moment, then you'll end up waiting forever. Or even worse, if you get caught up imagining that you need extra gear or some kind of technology you don't have access to, then your need for a better camera or computer or synthesizer becomes yet another excuse to not make something. So instead you try to use the limiting factors or the chaos factors as part of whatever it is you are creating, instead of attempting some kind of escape or waiting for things to quiet down. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but to me I've begun to imagine that it's a good sign when at the very moment I try to make something there appears some kind of pushback or problem to contend with. That being said, if I lived in a mansion, you better believe I would have an elevator that went half a mile down into a bunker, where my studio would be located in a sealed vault, and where I would slide into a flotation tank that had some kind of ketamine mist that it pumped into the air, allowing me to telepathically recall my thoughts while traveling through alternate dimensions. Unfortunately, we are not there yet. Would need to get the Patron up to 100k a month for that. Regardless, we have a wonderful podcast for you today. We are gonna jump right into it, but first this.
Welcome back, friends. We got some silence, praise God. But really, you know, I kind of like the text-to-speech thing. Maybe I'll just start doing that from now on. There's something really liberating about knowing this, like, digital English person is gonna take over your voice. It's fantastic. This is the future that I long for, you know, or so many things were born into it. You know, you're born in, I didn't want to talk this way. I didn't want to look this way, to be honest with you. I mean, some of my friends who are, you know, into a certain idea of reincarnation would actually say, well, the truth is you did sign up for that. Exactly that thing that you're in right now, you signed up for. And P.S., I'm not trying to bash myself. I mean, I love this form that I've taken. I just like it that I didn't have to grow a beard to make it seem like I had a chin. You know, that kind of thing. I don't know why when I'm in the Department of Reincarnation, when they're like, do you want a nice, strong, beautiful, powerful, symmetrical chin? Or do you kind of want to like a stork thing? And I'm always like, oh, I'll do the stork and just grow a beard. That's the thing where I can't wait for that video or whatever you get before you go into the next incarnation of that. I would like to have a conversation with the self that chose that, by the way. Similarly, you know, I don't quite understand this voice. You know, it wouldn't have been the first voice I picked. I would want like some kind of beautiful, booming, deep voice. You know, again, I'm not saying I don't like myself. I like myself, but these are the kinds of things we have to deal with. You're just born. You're born a certain way. That's just how it is. You're going to be a certain, you're going to have a certain height. You know, I've got scoliosis. So you're going to have you're going to have like weird shit. I got one ball. I don't know did I sign up for that? Did I say, hey, how about no chin and one ball? Let's do that. I wasn't born with one ball, by the way. I had to get one of my testicles removed. But anyway, this is what I look forward to if the transhumanists are right and we're going to get to a point where nanobots can disassemble our bodies and reassemble them instantaneously so we can get to experience every possible form. Come on. As much as we have a culture of like, you got to love yourself, how many people are going to not instantaneously change some aspect of their identity immediately? How many people who up until that day have been like showing Instagram memes that say, love yourself, or the wonderful videos you see of the children doing the sweet affirmations in front of the mirror saying, oh God, I love you. I do that sometimes when I'm hyper depressed. That's one of my tricks. And it honestly, I'm not sure it works that well. But I just would love to know how many people, when it does finally, when we get into that place where you just like, you know, press a button on your iPhone, you can turn into a tiger, a lamb, a tree, you know, a Neanderthal or a whale, or you can, you know, shift your voice instantly, or can painlessly all of a sudden have boobs. You know, how many people are going to like not change themselves? Give me a break. Everyone's going to, you won't know anyone from, you won't even know your friends are anymore. Everyone will look so different, probably. People turn into little gnomes, and people turn into snakes and cats. You won't have any idea what anything is when that happens. And I look forward to that moment, but hopefully there's some precursor moments where you could just be like, you know what? I want to grow my ball back. I want that weird little bald spot on the top of my head to fill in again. I want my eyes to be a vivid blue. I want to have a powerful chin. And let's get the Brad Pitt abs from Fight Club. And let's experiment with that weird tattoo idea I had when I was in high school. Fuck it, let's do that. And then probably definitely make my dick bigger. And then, I don't know, let's add a couple feet to the old body size. Size it up a little bit, get some biceps. I'd like to be able to play Flight of the Bumblebee on my Moog. That'd be pretty awesome. And yeah, then after that, let's see what it feels like to be a cabbage. This is what I would do, but who knows? We don't know. We're not there yet. In the meantime, we've got the computer to do that stuff for us and our imaginations. And until then, yeah, love yourself, because what else are you going to do? You know, push up, sit up, start running, jogging. Give me a break. What are you going to do? Start eating healthy? You're going to start eating healthy? Is that what you're going to do? You're going to stop eating these fucking perfect bars that are everywhere? I don't know if you guys have had these. Not sponsored, by the way, but they're delicious. But I'm starting to think these are just candy bars. Because there's no way these things are okay to eat. I don't know if what I'm saying at this point. My point is, yeah, love yourself until you can change yourself into a jellyfish instantaneously. Wonderful podcast for you today. Brandi Jordan is here with us. We're going to jump right into it. But first this. We're back. Look, I know what you're thinking. I don't want commercials in my podcast. I want it to be a straight shot through with no interruptions. And I understand. If you're interested in commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. If you subscribe to the video tiers, you're going to have access to all kinds of stuff that we've been doing. We have a weekly meditation every Tuesday. We've got a family gathering every Friday. And next Wednesday, that is Wednesday, July 17th, whatever next Wednesday is. It's July 9th right now. I don't feel like doing the math. That's where I'm at in my life. In the pandemic, I could look at a calendar. I'm gonna look at a calendar. What's wrong with me? Let's see here. Yeah, next Wednesday is the 15th. In fact, we're gonna be doing we're starting a book club, and we're reading Dune. So if you're interested, sign up patreon.com/DTFH. We also have a wonderful shop. We've got face masks, baby. You want crow's milk face masks? We got them. All kinds of stuff over there. Beautiful garments for you to wear on your body. Just go to DougAtrussell.com and click on the shop link. Okay, friends, let's do this thing. Today's guest is a brilliant human. This is a podcast that definitely I'm still spinning from it. Got a lot of data that I'm not going to spoil for you right now regarding what it's like to be a black person in the United States. And I think it's really important right now to, as much as possible, get as much of that data as you can if you don't happen to be a black person in the United States. It's crazy to me that all this time I've had my face shoved into a variety of conspiracy theories, when one of the more sinister conspiracies that I've ever heard of that is verifiable, as verifiable can be, is happening every day to black people who are in this country. And wow, fuck. It's crazy, and it changes you in a good way, I think, but it definitely isn't a comfortable thing necessarily. I don't mean to spoil the podcast for you. Honestly, when I reached out to Brandy to have this conversation, I thought we were going to talk about birth. She's a postpartum doula, a newborn care specialist, and a lactation consultant, and a pediatric sleep specialist, and I wanted to talk about babies. But the conversation, it didn't really hang out there that much, and I'm glad that we didn't hang out there that much. It got really intense, really heavy, and really, really, for me, very important. So I hope you enjoy it. If you enjoy this conversation, why not sign up for one of Brandy Jordan's anti-racist parenting workshops? There will be a link for that at DuncanTrussell.com. Now, please, everybody, shine your divine internal rainbow astral light through the mycelial spiritual network that connects all beings that it comes raining down on today's guest. Welcome to the DTFH, Brandy Jordan. Brandy, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. I am so excited to chat with you. When Erin told me that she was friends with you and that there was this possibility, I was thrilled because I have yet to chat with anyone on the podcast who is a midwife. A doula. What's the right? I don't even know the right word for it. Is it doula or is there
a doula? There is such a thing as a midwife. I'm not a midwife.
So what's the parents?
I don't help them actually deliver the baby. Like, I'm not catching any babies. So it's a non-medical role. Midwife.
Okay. I got
to your OBGYN.
Now, I was doing a little bit of research into this, and the history of specifically African-American midwives. I was wondering if maybe you could just talk a little bit about that, or if that is not something that you feel like talking about, or if that's not a good place to start.
How many hours do you have is more of the question.
Okay, it was the right question. Yes.
So, I mean, in America, obviously, we have a 400-year history of enslaved people who were Black Americans from Africa, and they were the ones who delivered the babies, both for their masters, owners, and for themselves. Hmm. And so those were the women that they sought out in the community to deliver babies. And many of those women delivered hundreds and hundreds of babies without incident. When there became, modern medicine as we think about it today, which were mostly white males who became, obstetricians and gynecologists, they began to kind of demonize these women and say they were unclean and they didn't know what they were talking about and they didn't know science. And that kind of was the demise of midwifery as we knew it back then. But they were the ones who are responsible for a lot of us being here right now, both ancestors, white and Black.
Right.
And a lot of them, their names may never be known, for especially for a lot of Black Americans who may not have had birth certificates, but thousands and thousands of days, thousands of babies. They were basically the ones who brought their knowledge to this country and helped the people that enslaved them deliver their babies safely. Ooh. Most of the time.
That's got to be some cognitive dissonance there.
Yeah,
delivering the child of the person who is human trafficking you.
Yeah.
How, what?
And then nursing their babies.
Oh, that's so wild. That is so wild. Is the reason, like when we first started chatting and I called you a midwife versus a doula, that's partially connected to this history, right?
Connected. I mean, women always assisted other women in birth, and whatever civilization you look at, that was just a thing that happened. And so for a lot of people, their family members were the ones that would do that. You had an aunt or a grandma or somebody that was just a person you knew in the village or in the community. That was a person that came and helped everyone with their babies. My own mother, who's from Mississippi, her name is Maggie, and the midwife who birthed her named her Maggie. So that was the kind of relationship. that these midwives have in their communities. Yeah.
And is there some, there's, you know, okay, so I'll tell you what I used to think about it, which was completely informed by what you're talking about, which is a paradigm that has been put out there by white people that is now, I mean, studying it, that is connected to slavery. Another thing, just no idea, but I will tell you what I used to think. And it and then going and studying it, you realize, my God, you're so conditioned, because what I, the things I thought, you can go on Wikipedia literally, and it shows you what was put out there, which is just what you're saying, superstitious, dangerous, basically like witchcraft, like
basically,
like some form of like dangerous witchcraft that was, you know, had its roots in African religions, maybe. And that also, I think there was the problem was one of power, which is that doctors, there were people who would rather go to a midwife to have their baby delivered because it's super expensive to go to a doctor and have your baby delivered by a doctor. And also, I think, is it fair to say back then it seemed kind of weird and unnatural to all of a sudden have to bring yourself to a hospital or bring yourself to a dude who is going to...
Also, males just weren't as involved in the birth process, and that's even partners weren't as involved. So that obviously was something different. And so they had to have a way to convince women that it was better and safer to come into a hospital. And they did that by demonizing these women. I mean, I didn't know about midwifery until I was probably about 19 or 20, which was like a blessing. I was listening to NPR at the time, and they had this story of this old time career called midwifery that, you know, women were doing, but it was very much painted as something that was created by like white women hippies. Like there was no mention of the being rooted in, you know, African-American culture or in the history of America. So that's something that I learned along the way, but it's really what opened my knowledge and curiosity into supporting women in birth. You know, I cold called I'm from Houston, so I cold called a birth center there. It was like, I just heard this story on NPR. I want to know what this is all about. And for whatever weird reason, they allowed a 19-year-old to come and be with them and work with them and kind of change the trajectory of my life. And so 20 years later, I'm still working with moms and babies. So was that for that story?
Had you seen a birth before that? Had you been in the presence of a birth before?
I have three sisters and we're all like 10 years apart. And so my oldest sister had my nephew when I was 16 and I was in the birthing room with her. And so I did see a birth when I was 16. And then the second birth that I saw at the birth center, I was 19 or 20 at the time. And this couple had a 10-pound baby in water. And I was like, oh, like, my God, like, bodies can do this? Like, what is this? Like, that to me is witchcraft. Like, how was she able to do this?
Yes.
And it's not like you said, like, no one was screaming and there wasn't blood everywhere. And I was like, okay, so this is 100% not what I've been conditioned to believe that birth is, that it can be something very different. And I had the pleasure of learning that at 20 years of age before having my own children and going down that road.
Do you think you could chat a little bit about that specifically in the sense that my idea of what birth is and my experience of birth is more what's in the zeitgeist, because we went to a hospital. We had the injections. I saw my wife was going to have an epidural and they messed it up. Something went wrong. And I watched my wife, her pulse just start going down. I watched, she didn't see it. She didn't see the look on the doctor's face. She didn't see the look on the nurse's face. I saw the moment of it going from being, oh, this is just a, you know, what we do, to, oh shit, something's really off here. Erin was just saying she couldn't feel under her neck, but suddenly my entire life in that moment went from, you know, my idea of what was going to happen, which is, oh, you know, I don't know. They give her a needle. It doesn't hurt. Then I have a son. This is how it's going to go. To, I think I might watch my soulmate die right now in front of me with my son in her belly. Now, also, prior to that, of course, we've all heard the whole thing of like, it's a bloody, screaming mess. And it feels like what you're saying is actually what that is what birth turned into versus yes, exactly. what it, and I wonder if you could chat about that a little bit with us.
Well, I always tell people, you know, people have this idea that doulas and midwives are like, you have to have a natural birth and you got to be at home and you need to be like a bear in the woods. And that's like, I love science. My minor's in science. So it's not that, like, not everyone is a good candidate to have a baby outside the hospital. There are many people who need to be in a hospital, and I'm so grateful we have hospitals for that.
Right.
I have one home birth and two hospital births, and they were all amazing births. So it's just not about the hospital. It's the way in which we care for families and pregnant people. That is the issue.
Gotcha.
And so thinking about, you know, the midwifery model of care is more of what is important for us to be thinking about. So your midwife knows you. They know the couple. They know the children. You know, your visits are about 1 to 2 hours long. You know, I think about my time with my OBGYN, we probably didn't spend more than 7-8 minutes together
right.
during our visits. And so, you know, so much of birth is about trust, the ability to let go, the ability to, you know, get yourself like in the zone, so to speak.
Yes.
And when you're not in a space where you feel that type of connection with people, where you feel that kind of safety, what comes up for a lot of people is fear. And we know fear doesn't make you feel relaxed or make you feel like you want to release anything. You're going to hold tight and you're going to get stiff. And that's the exact opposite of what we want in birth. When you're trying to let go and like let this person that you've been protecting for 9 months come from your body to the outside world.
Right.
And so I think it's more of the idea that we don't have that kind of community connection with our healthcare providers. They don't really know you. And, you know, I'm thinking about as a Black woman, where we're more like 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. There's also that. You're walking into that. Yes.
Wow.
In LA, in some places, 10 times. Racism and bias is the only reason.
How can you go deeper into that? What is the...
Yeah. So, you know, we know that people have, people don't listen. They don't trust Black women. When they say they're in pain or they have concerns, they're usually brushed off. And so in Los Angeles, for example, they're 4 times more likely to die. And it's regardless of income, socioeconomic status, health status, it's simply bias. And so it might be that, you know, some things they might take more seriously with, you know, a non-Black patient, they're not taking us seriously, or they're brushing off, or they see them as annoying or complaining, and not taking those same precautions that they would take with, you know, other patients. In places like New York, DC, it's 10 times more likely to die in childbirth.
What?
Yes. And so it's a crisis. And so you think about if you're going into birth already concerned, like how many clients do I have to say, like, I'm afraid of dying. Not everyone is saying that about their birth, that their fear is dying, you know? And if you don't have that relationship with your doctors, most doctors in the United States don't necessarily look like the clients in which they are serving. They don't know the issue. They have preconceived notions about their families. You know, I know with my first child, every time I went, the women would be like, oh, so how are you going to do this on your own? They all assumed I was a single mom. I don't have to, you know, tell you to guess why that was. You know, simply just the way in which they, you know, the way in which they interacted with me didn't lead to a lot of trust happening between us.
I have to apologize. I have not heard what you've been saying because my mind is grappling with that statistic that I have never heard before.
Yes.
That is the most, I mean, of all the things, everything we're hearing right now, regarding African American experience are like something out of Invasion of the Body Snatchers level of like, holy fuck. But that I one, I did, what?
A poster that someone wrote for one of the recent marches, and it said, doctors do to Black women what police do to Black men.
Oh man.
Wow. And I wish it didn't resonate with me, but it did. And I tell people this story. I've spoken about it a lot. My third baby, who's now 3, I went to hospital to deliver him, my third baby. And And for a little precursor, my second baby was born in 50 minutes. So this will give you some precursor. 50? 50, 5-0.
Congrats.
Luckily, it was a planned home birth. But this one I was having at the hospital, and I arrived at the hospital, you know, third baby, you know, what's happening. The doctor, you know, I say I'm in labor, you know, my water started trickling. And he's like, I think you may have peed yourself and you thought it was your water leaking. I was like, well, okay, I'm going to let that one go. And I said, well, I'm in labor, you know, it's my third baby. And he said to me word for word, it doesn't matter that you think you're in labor. What matters is when I think you're in labor.
Holy shit.
And so at this point, like, you know, this is my third baby. We're an hour into this. And I'm like, you know, I know where I'm at and I know what's happening. And so he wouldn't admit me. So that meant we had to stay in a little triage room. I don't know if you've been in a triage room, but it's like the size of like a janitor's closet.
Right.
And it didn't have like a door or anything like that. And so I was having to go from this little closet to like the public bathroom and the lobby back and forth while I'm laboring my child. So like every moan, every cry, like anyone who's in the waiting room is basically having this experience with me. And so at one point we got in there, doesn't have a real bed. It has like kind of like a cot situation, but it became too uncomfortable. So I got on my hands and knees on the cold floor. And I remember thinking like, how am I expected to do what I know I need to do in these circumstances where I'm not even worthy of getting a hospital bed on a slow night on a Tuesday? Now the important piece of this story is that this is a hospital that I worked at for 5 years at the same time this was happening and in the same department, but I didn't have on my fancy white coat. And so I was just another Black mom coming to this hospital. And so word got around, obviously, that I was an employee. And then the brigades came in and then the whole situation changed.
Wow.
But I'm thinking about someone like me, like I've been in maternal child health for 20 years. You know, I have a master's degree. I have all the things you could think about as far as like the education and the whatever. And I still was not given what I know they give to clients every single night that I've been there working there for 5 years. And so I think about if I had to endure that, think about someone who doesn't have the background, who doesn't have people. I had a doula, I had my husband, I had those people to advocate for me. But many women don't have that. I don't even know how they can advocate for themselves. And that's how they die. I was going to be at home.
Here's a woo-woo interpretation, and feel free to slap it down.
I will.
Do you feel like maybe people like... It almost sounds like you were given that experience by the universe so that you could tell people about it, because the odds of having worked at that hospital, having seen what happens when people of color come in versus white people, for them to not know you were connected, it's like you were given a story. In the most awful way you could possibly be given a story, because you're not someone who's like, well, I've read this, you know, I've read this in sociology papers, or I've heard it, where in all those things people want to refute because it's easier. I don't want to live in the world that you're describing.
Right, right, right. I mean, like I tell everyone, you know, even hearing that story, just know that I'm one of the lucky ones. I've been able to come home 3 times alive with 3 alive babies. So I'm one of the lucky ones, you know? So when I tell this story, you know, I can tell this from a place of gratitude because I am alive. My babies are alive. And that's not the case for a lot of women who look like me. So I am grateful because I do have the platform to be able to say, hey, this does happen. And I'm someone that you guys consider respectable. Like I've done all the things you're supposed to do in America to be quote unquote respectable. And this still happened to me. So yes, I think it is a gift that it happened, but more importantly, a gift that I'm alive and my baby's alive. Yeah. And I didn't go home as they instructed me to do during this labor. And so, you know, I think about all the people who don't have this. And this is one of thousands of examples that I can give on my own personal, you know, history with just navigating through society. So I know what it looks like. You know, I have the moms who call and say, what do I do? Like, you know, I feel like I'm dying. Like, how do I advocate for myself? Who do I talk to? Who do I call? Like, is it like a lot of them are now afraid to go to the hospital. So we have the other thing happening that you have people who want to have a baby at home by themselves because they're so afraid of what can happen in other settings. And I always say this is not a referendum on hospital versus home birth because I think they're both valuable. because even that birth experience turned out to be something really beautiful. The doctor who then came and relieved this person was amazing, and he turned it around, and it was this amazing experience.
Yes.
I think you can have a beautiful birth in either place, but it's knowing how to advocate for yourself and having people who really believe in family-centered, women-centered, you know, birth person-centered care.
In the future, and I just want to put it out there that I hope this is the future, where this period in American history, global history, of catastrophe becomes the what people look back on as like when we really did face facts. And somehow, and God knows, I have no idea how, somehow on the other side of this, we do have equality. We do have, we've come to terms with it. There's been, I don't know what the word for even that is, it some kind of global healing or evolution or
something? I think it's healing and equity is what we need.
So equity.
Yes. People say equality, but you can't give people the same when we've had, you know, 450 years of difference. And so a lot of people talk about like, we just want the same. No, we need equity. So if you had a 450 year head start, we have to figure out how we create equity in that race, unfortunately. And there's no easy answers to that that's going to make everyone happy.
Do you say unfortunately? Why do you say unfortunately? You say unfortunately because you recognize the just sheer impossibility in that. I mean, it's, you know, is that why it's you impossible. Say unfortunately?
It's not impossible. I am a very positive thinking person, so it's not impossible. You know, my grandmother who just turned 99 in April, thinking about what she experienced in her 100 years living, almost 100 years living in the United States, to go from what she, you know, like separate, you know, fountains, my parents experienced drinking from separate water fountains. They're from the South as well. And to now see that some of that same rhetoric is happening in the United States, like, I don't know that feels like progress to them. If anything, it probably feels more like a setback because they were alive and around during the civil rights movement. So for them, it feels like we're a setback, not in progress. So, you know, I want to remain hopeful for my children, and I'm doing what I can to create that equity and to give them the idea that yes, they can still do what they want and become what they want. And that's what I was taught, regardless of what's happening around. But I can't say that I'm entirely hopeful that it's so possible for myself, just because I know so many of the liberal, well-meaning people that I know are unwilling to really unpack their own racism and bias. And that's the issue. And if I can't get them to see it, how in the heck are we going to get the other people to see it?
Yeah, I mean, that is the issue, isn't it? Because it is, it does just come down. I mean, it's easier for me to do that because I was raised by, I was raised in the South. And my, this is the problem. I'll tell you the problem. The problem is we love our parents, but one of my parents was not a liberal in the closet racist. One of my parents was a born in the South racist. Do you, you know, that's what I was born. I was, and I'm not trying to do like, therefore I'm okay. Any of the excuse, I'm just saying that's the water that was poured into my plant that is me, you know? And so at least if I'm like looking into myself and seeing bias and seeing like my experience as a kid and remembering what my, some of the things my father would say to me, and then having to like pull those things away from his soul, which was beautiful. Every human soul is beautiful, but having to pull away from that soul, damn.
But you know, I tell people that like I'm from the South. I can tell you pretty much every racist thing that's happened to me has happened in Los Angeles, not in the South. And so you have this idea that like things are so much worse in the South, and you know, and that's not the case. I think that it's easier for people to say, oh yeah, that's a problem that's in the South, or that's a problem in Texas, you know. But that then keeps people from actually unpacking their own thing. Like I hear people talking about Trump all the time and this person and that person. I'm like, okay, let's put all people aside, say none of them exist. How are you personally responsible for upholding and benefiting the system? And that's where you have to start. We have to stop looking outside of what's happening. And a lot of people don't want to address that.
No.
It's painful, makes you feel guilty. and you have to name some things you don't want to name. And until everyone is willing to do that, it's not going to change. And also people of color have a lot of their own unpacking to do. Like, we also get brought up in the same system. And so I had to, like, for myself over the past 41 years of my life, kind of unpack all the internalized anti-Blackness and racism that I absorbed to be able to walk through the system.
That's wild. That's interesting, because I don't think people that can you talk a little bit about that angle, which is that, you know,
honestly, Black people are raised to make white people feel comfortable. Everything that I was taught, and it wasn't said in those terms, but I understood that my physical, emotional, financial well-being was very much rooted in making a certain population comfortable in many ways, making my boss feel comfortable, making myself feel seem non-confrontational, making sure, you know, I didn't know the own texture of my hair until I was 30, because my hair was chemically straightened until I was 30. And I realized that I actually didn't even know the own texture of my hair, because this hair was considered non-professional, disheveled, the actual hair that comes out of my head.
What?
You know, you think about, you know, every child of color will tell you that their parents always told them you need to be twice as good and work twice as hard to get the same. That's what we all were raised on. And that's not something I'm passing on to my kids, because I don't feel like my kids need to do more or be smarter. They just are, you know, they just have to be them to do what they want to do. But when you give that to children, and my parents did it because they wanted to protect me and they wanted me to be able to have something, but it also was a burden as well. You know, so I had to unpack, like, I don't need to prove myself to anyone, because by saying that, I'm almost signing up to the idea that I'm inferior in some way.
People, this is one of the things that I didn't know. I feel embarrassed. The whole thing, it's not just guilt, it's embarrassment. You feel, I don't think that we have quite the word for it, for the experience of what a lot of us are feeling right now. Guilt is part of it, but it's...
Guilt, I think shame is probably a big part of it. There's shame.
I think it's a new...
On both sides.
I think it's a nice gumbo of all kinds of stuff like that, that really is, makes you, if you really do, you know, I've worked with these spiritual people for years, and I've been taught mindfulness, how to work with my thoughts, mm-hmm. how to sit with my thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I feel lucky for that, because I can create a little bit of space around the sensation of, holy shit, man. You was right. It wasn't like this was hidden in a vault somewhere. It wasn't like you had to go dig underneath the Vatican or some shit to get an ancient scroll and look at it. You could have talked to any Black person for 10 minutes and asked them, what's it like being a kid in America if you're Black? Easy thing.
The thing is, how many of them would have honestly answered that?
I don't know.
Years ago, not many.
And I wouldn't have felt comfortable asking the question. That's the other thing.
They wouldn't have felt comfortable answering.
Yeah.
And so I think people are having a much needed, you know, 450 years late conversation. And there's no way to get to the next side until we all have these conversations. It's like family. You got to hash it out. You got to say your piece. You maybe got to be mad with each other for a little bit to come back to some kind of, okay, this is what we're going to do to fix this.
Right.
We're in that phase right now. Like, we're having some hard conversations, you know, and they have to be had, because when you don't have them, like, you don't see me, you don't see my experience. And everyone's learning that, because, I mean, it wasn't until I went to college that I knew much about Black history, because it's not something that we are taught. I remember in high school, I was taught that Rosa Parks gave up her seat because she was just tired. Her feet hurt. Like, that's how I learned that's how she gave up her, you know, she wouldn't give up her seat on the bus because she was just so tired.
Oh my God. That is insidious.
So tired. And I remember, like, all the pictures had her with gray hair, whatever. She was, like, I think 43 or something when this happened. Like, she wasn't like 85, like I was taught in high school. So I was like, if you have those kind of narratives and everyone's getting that same education of this watered down idea of what it was like, you know, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years ago, it makes sense that we're kind of like, oh, well, it wasn't that bad. They were really friends. They loved each other. Black people loved being slaves. It wasn't that bad.
Right. Well, that, right.
I've heard people say things like this.
This is, I mean, so, you know, Gone with the Wind, classic American cinema. So the other, like, way before the pandemic, my wife and I sat down to watch Gone with the Wind, not because of, like, any racial thing, but just, you know, this is one of those movies they say
is one of
classics. You watch, that is the most racist, fucked up movie right from the start.
But can I tell you how much I loved this movie when I was,
you
like,
did.
In junior high? Does that tell you the level of brainwashing, I don't know what you want to call it, but the level of complicity that we all have to play in the system.
Wow.
Like, I want to say, when I probably watched that movie probably 15, 20 times. And that's like, what, a 4-hour long movie? Like,
yeah.
I watched it so many times.
It is.
And I was not horrified.
That version of the South is a version of the South where if you're a slave, you're kind of like, oh, well, you know, it's better than where I came from. You know, yeah, this and, exactly. and that.
And they, you know, they take care of you. We're family.
You're part of our family. You're not a, you haven't been human trafficked.
I don't own you.
You're not a hostage. You're not an unpaid hostage. You're lucky. Basically, you're lucky that we got you. And
that's what most people learn. Most kids learn. So, you know, it already starts from, you know, elementary school, that you're already being taught either superiority or inferiority, depending on, you know, what color your skin is when you enter to the traditional schooling in America. So no one escapes this. So whether you're liberal, you're conservative, everyone's getting that same education. And so, you know, I always tell people, I'm not a jackass whisperer. Like, I have no intention of turning people who are racist, not racist. Like, they can continue to be racist. Like, I'm not working with those people, but I do work with people who want to see things change, who are looking for equity, to see how they play a part in this, call them on that, call them in and out, and figure out how you can make the change start with you. That's the people that I work with. I'm not looking to change hearts and minds of people who don't want them change, but I definitely think there's a lot more people who don't know how complicit they are and need someone to kind of shine the mirror. And it happens in every aspect of life, whether it's childbirth, parenting. You know, I think about just looking for a preschool for my kids, and LA was like trying to, you know, apply to Harvard because there was just so few options. And you walk into some of these places like, oh my God, my kid's going to be the black kid. And my kids are biracial, so they have privilege in that. Like, they don't have my same skin.
Right.
They're exotic, you know, they can be fetishized and seem like they're exotic.
Right.
You know, and there's an issue in that as well. You know,
right.
So there's so many different layers to all the things that come into parenthood, like, play into this as well.
Well, I mean, this is, thank you for that, by the way. And here, this is what I wanted to ask you after this. And again, after we have achieved equity, mm-hmm. and I do think it's possible. I think partially because of the technology we have right now, it can happen. Before, I don't know. But now we have technology, so it's hard to suppress data like what you're putting out right now. I didn't know it. A lot of people hearing it just didn't know it. But this is my question. So we have achieved equity. I don't know what that's going to look like, but we're looking back at this time period. What do you think is going to be the analysis of a society where black people are being publicly executed in the streets, where if they go to give birth, they are 4 to 6 to 10 times more likely to die?
Yeah.
What is the word for that is what I want to know. What are people going to say this was?
A genocide.
It's genocide.
Yes.
But it's like genocide evolved. It's like someone looked at what the Nazis did and said, whoa. They were way too out front in the way they're getting rid of Jews. You can't just do it like that. You've got to do a slow boil genocide or something. But that is what it is. But
it's genocide. I mean, America has perfected that. I mean, you started with the natives. So this isn't the first time.
Right.
But yes, I mean, I would call it genocide. I mean, I think about, you know, 1985, like, do you know anywhere else in the world, like, or in the United States, were they able to drop bombs on family homes in the United States of America? That's what happened in 1985 in Philadelphia, killing women and children inside a home in Philadelphia.
Right.
like on our own soil, where, how else would that be allowed without outrage and people, you know, in the streets, in the voting box, changing everything? But no one cared because it was Black people.
When you say,
or not, I think they didn't care enough to do more than care. Because I think a lot of people do truly care.
Sure.
And I say that really honestly and genuinely. I know a lot of people who care, but not enough to actually move beyond that feeling, because feelings pass.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of people in Germany who cared too. Now, yeah. I want to know, when you, so with it, with genocide, the, what you're saying is there's intentionality. It's, yes. You know, and so this, I would love to chat with you about that. If the intentionality implies a power, intelligent decisions that are intentionally being made to kill Black people, to reduce yes. the population of Black people in yes. America. So
I mean,
who's making the decisions?
Look at, you can look at the criminal justice system. You know, I want to say that the prison population, I want to say, is probably about 50 something percent Black men when they make up, I don't know, 15, 20% of the population, when white males are committing the same amount of crimes. But that's not the narrative that you get on the news.
No.
You know, you think about during the drug crisis, you know, a Black man having two, you know, rocks of crack in their hand would go to jail for 20 to 30 years.
Yep.
And cocaine, which is something that was not something that usually people in urban areas were selling, you could have a kilo and do, you know, 15 months. There's an intentionality to that because we know what communities are doing what. The fact that they actually brought drugs into the Black communities, that was by the CIA, and that's very much documented that was done on purpose.
Yep.
So, you know, you think about families, you know, they changed the way that welfare worked, that you could not get welfare if you were married. So think about what that did to communities wow. of color. If you couldn't be married to get the sustenance that you needed, that meant that you didn't get married. And so you had generations of families not getting married. And that broke down the family, you know, community that was needed to strive in so many of these, you know, underserved areas.
This,
well, think about schools.
The question I'm asking you, and I don't know if anyone even has the answer though, is who is orchestrating this? Like, it's so sinister.
I think it's many people, corporations, government. I think whoever benefits financially is who is orchestrating this. Because just put it this way, let's just say the top 1% said, you know what? I don't want to have racism anymore. I don't want to have discrimination. Their money is what fuels everything. And so if they said, I'm not going to shop for any of these corporations that have someone who's supporting X, those corporations would no longer cease to be in existence. All if right. they said, this person is saying this, you know, and I don't want to pay for this, they're going to lose all their sponsors because they're going to pay attention to where the money flows.
Right.
And so we know that there is money and people being poor. There's money and people being divided, you know, especially for the criminal justice system. It funds many of the corporations, the labor, basically our new evolved way of doing slavery.
Right.
Happens in the prison system.
Right.
And so there is a financial benefit to creating a caste system.
Right. Now,
they're not calling it that.
But this is where the conspiracy theorist part of me, this is the part, because I do go on Reddit conspiracy every night. I shouldn't. I have horrible dreams.
I'm sorry.
It's the worst. It's the best and the worst. Don't do it. I love Hollow Earth theory. Part of me, I'm not embarrassed to say, believes there could be civilizations in the core of the earth. I hope so. But this stuff that you're talking about, this is, to me, the crown jewel of what of conspiracy. And by conspiracy, I don't mean like, therefore it's not real. I mean, holy shit. If apocalypse means lifting of the veil, then this is the most apocalyptic collective realization that any society I've ever heard of is having right now, which is no. This isn't just, we just haven't quite figured out a way to balance the scales. You're looking at a slow motion genocide that is being perpetrated by the wealthy to eradicate people of color. And it is so insidious. And it is so ingrained in us that even though it's clearly happening, we saw it happen. We just saw it happen. I mean, maybe
we explain it away. If you've been taught your entire life that Black people are dangerous and lazy, then how could you see it that way? Just another criminal getting what he deserves.
That's right.
Like, you know, think about, I grew up watching Cops, like, as a family show.
Like, me too.
How, I mean, I was taught as well. Like, you can make Black people afraid of their own people. Like, if that's every image that you see, you start to believe that. And so you have this idea that if I dress a certain way, I go to college, like, these are the things that makes me different and protects me. And then you get the huge wake-up call once you become an adult and be like, well, that was a little bullshit. Like, I've done all that shit and I'm no, you know, I'm not safer than I was doing any of those things.
I'm going to stop harping on this particular point.
I hear what you're saying.
Who
is a lot of people, everyone.
Is it a demon? Is it the, you know, a demon in the sense of like, Carl Jung had this theory that everyone has a shadow, the side that you don't want to show. Mm-hmm. And the collective shadow, if enough people are repressing the truth in a society, then that collective shadow will manifest as a tyrant. That's what happens. If enough people are not looking into it, not going through the thing that you will feel if you really look deep into this as a white person, then what happens is it jumps out of us. It takes on a form. It takes on the form of an Adolf Hitler. An Adolf Hitler appears, and then you get that. But in this case, and as you're describing it, it feels like I don't want to call Trump Adolf Hitler, not because I like Trump, but because I think it's assigning too much organization to that person. He just seems like a speed freak lunatic. Hitler was a speed freak too, and a lunatic, but there was this diabolical
dark ideology and philosophies that I don't believe that Trump necessarily has thought through that deeply.
Here's the part that, and again, and this, I'm not trying, I'm sorry, but here's the problem. If we get a narcissist, sociopath, speed freak, it doesn't matter what he thinks. Mm-hmm. We just need to get around him and like start putting little ideas in his head. Somebody's like, you know, remember, I'm sure you do. Remember when the racists were marching with their white torches, just like the Nazis did? One of them ran over.
I think it was in Charlotte.
And
the very fine people in Charlotte. That
yes. Now, someone may have just told him, here's what you say, but these, you know, or when he accidentally puts in his tweet, thanks to the SS for clearing out these people.
It's intentional. Like, yeah.
Yes. Right.
I'm sure someone like Stephen Miller, who is the orchestrator of much of what he does it on purpose because they want to incite their base, the populist movement. Like, we've seen it before.
So there you go.
They know who their base is and what they want, whether he believes it or not. He knows it gets them fired up, and that's what gets votes, and that's what got him elected.
So
and
we
can continue to fire them up.
And that is dyed in the wool, unapologetic white supremacists puppeteering our political system. That is not.
And I think the problem is that when we say the word white supremacy, most people are thinking about people wearing a white hat and burning crosses. And yes, that can be one facet of white supremacy, but it's also giving me a home loan that has 4% more APR than a white person. It's also, you know, making me wait in the bank line for 45 minutes. You can check to make sure my check is a real check.
Yep.
Like, that all is the same thing. It's also like my kid being like the token Black kid at a school, you know, and that's the one you want to always take a picture of and put him on your front of your thing, even though he's the only Black child. You know, it's all of that. And so I think until we start seeing white supremacy with a broader lens, you're going to continue to be focused on Trump. And he is such a minor part of the issue. He is a culmination of what we already had. He just is allowing you guys a mirror to see it.
Well, I mean, that's where they really screwed up, because they put somebody out there that just couldn't be subtle about it. And now, because of that, it's that's the weird gift. Not just that, that he's given us, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to call this a gift, because that the execution of George Floyd will go down in history as one of the most horrific things that as a society we had, like, we had to watch that. That's there forever. That's never going to get forever. But where what happened there was, what it's like the thing, God, this is, forgive me, anything I say is just not going to be sufficient.
And but, you say it anyway, and that's how we move forward.
Thank you. Oh, God, I'm so dumb. The movie Predator, right? This thing, right? He's in camouflage. You don't see it. Killing everybody, you don't see the thing. It's like he's using this weird camouflage, and then suddenly, finally, you see the fucking monster. There it is, plain as day. And once you see the monster, you can fight it. You know it's there. You can't deny it anymore.
Right.
That was the human sacrifice that was George Floyd, is that you saw a human sacrifice. You saw...
I'll have to make an addendum. What? White people couldn't see it.
Exactly. And you're right.
Unfortunately, we have social media and video so that you guys, because before you would have been able to say, oh, well, that's not what happened. Like, no, he didn't do that. Like, he must have resisted. No, he must have had a gun. No, he must have been resisting.
Yep.
And now you're unable to do that because of video.
That's right. Oh, so, we've been telling since
1619. And now you guys see it with your own eyes. And so there's no way for you to tell your eyes that you didn't see what you saw.
That's right. Nope.
But even with that, I've seen people say that's not what happened, that it was a hoax, that
he died because of COVID because he had
COVID-19. That's why he died. And it wasn't because someone was on his neck. And so anyone will make an excuse, but I think it's forcing you all, just like, you know, watching people be beat on the Selma Bridge back in the 60s, forced white people to say, okay, this is not okay.
Right.
But do we do this every 80 years until we get it? Like, I'm hoping that's not the case.
No. No, I mean, it's no, I, no, I don't, no, it's no, I think you can't be complacent anymore, because that's the dream. The dream is to be on the bench. The dream is to be watching this thing go down as though you're watching a show. Cops, you want to feel like you're watching Cops. And right. Now you can't be complacent anymore. Now you have to look and by you.
You can no longer say you didn't know.
If you're complacent right now, then you're, as far
complacent
as I'm...
Complacent now, you're actually making a decision and a choice.
That's right. That's
you
right.
You can't say you didn't know. It's like, this is the 8 minutes and 46 seconds heard around the world. No one can say they didn't know now.
There you go. And what's that thing the Weather Underground said? Something like, ignoring violence is violence.
What you don't know at this point is willful ignorance. Like, everyone knows. But this is what, like, people knew before this. And this is what's probably frustrating to a lot of people of color, is that the idea that people need to watch basically black snuff films live on their Facebook feed in order to believe and trust that we've been telling the truth, that there are some people who don't quite treat us the same as they're treating you, that in itself is inhumane, it's dehumanizing, it's so many things. But the thing that kind of, I think, besides George Floyd, that kind of brought this to a head was Amy Cooper. I don't want to leave her out of this conversation.
Right.
Because that is a video you need to see to say that everyone knows. No one can say they don't know. Everyone knows. Because in that moment, you saw that she was skillfully and understood 100% what she could do with her whiteness to harm this black man who was telling her what to do in her park.
Right.
And everyone saw that.
Right.
And so this whole thing, I didn't know, you knew, it just didn't affect you in a way that made you care.
Right. Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's a sad genre, isn't it now?
Everyone has to unpack right now. You know, like I tell people, like, I'm married to a white male who clearly has a black wife and biracial children. So he's like in the struggle. He knows he's doing his work.
Yeah.
And I still have to check him. Like, no, this is not a thing. No, stop. You need to be quiet. You need to listen. You need to. So there's no one who is absolute from doing this work. Everyone has to do it. I don't care how deep you think you are in anti-racism work, how down you are, if you were the only white kid that grew up in the hood, like whatever your story is, none of that matters. You still have to unpack.
Can you tell me about the being quiet part?
The thing is, when you are taught that you are smart, you're the conquerors, you create civilizations, it creates a lot of sense of ownership in spaces. And so you go into spaces and the way that you own them, that's what you've been taught. And so sometimes you have to also unlearn not to take up so much space. Maybe you don't have to be the person who's sitting in the front. Maybe you don't have to be the person who's leading the conversation or leading the revolution. Like sometimes maybe you have to like join other people and let them do it and not be in front.
Yeah.
And, but that's something that has to be unlearned when you, your whole life has been like, yes, you are the people who lead us. Of course, that's what you're going to do. And so you have to actually unlearn that sometimes taking up space is another way that you have learned white supremacy, taking up too much space.
Yeah, that's the part that I have a very difficult time with, is shutting up. I love to yap.
Shutting up, it's just about knowing when.
Right, right. And
like everything doesn't belong to you. Like I think about like, you know, everyday things. Like there was that whole, I don't know if you saw the sidewalk challenge that a lot of people of color did.
Nope.
Most people expect for me to get off the sidewalk if we're both coming both places. Like what? I've done this and I've tested it out. Where did people learn that? Where did you expect that people of color are supposed to move out of the way for you on the sidewalk? Like, where did you learn that?
Holy shit.
It's so internalized that people don't see it. And I've had people literally like bulldoze me because their expectation was that I was going to move.
God.
Because that's what's supposed to happen. And I somehow internalized it because I was always moving.
Wow. I didn't even know that was a I didn't know that. I never even heard that.
So like now I tell people like simple things like that. Pay attention to how you are in spaces. You know, do that. Like every time you see someone, let's like move off the sidewalk and see what happens. Like, would you normally have done that? For many people, probably not. If they really were honest with themselves and they actually paid attention, is that you have this idea that they're in your space and they're supposed to work around you.
That's right. You know, these days I get off the damn sidewalk. I don't care who it is because of COVID, right? Like, I'm just trying to get the hell away from all human beings.
I think a lot of that might have changed because of COVID. But, you know, I see this all the time, like on buses or in trams, like, you know, and it's not just America. Like people, you know, will say, you know, we spend part-time in France, part-time in LA. And people say like, you know, is it less racist there? I'm like, it depends on who you ask. Like, I'm not wearing a hijab, so it's probably, yeah, for me, it's better.
Right.
But if you're wearing a hijab, it's probably not for that person.
You spend like, part-time in France?
Yeah, my husband's French.
Oh, come on. You got to invite us over. When are you going?
Yes,
we might not be able to go back, huh? Like, they're saying...
Yeah, July 1st are supposedly increasing it for America's failure to deal with COVID. They are possibly closing the borders just to American travel.
Wow. That is so crazy.
Here's the difference. It's not less racist, but the difference when I'm traveling overseas, because I've lived in Asia, I've lived in Europe, you know, obviously I'm from the States, is that there are plenty of people who don't like Black people, whatever. I don't care. You don't have to like me, but they aren't afraid of me. And that's the difference of being killed versus people just like, whatever, being rude. I don't care if you're rude,
right?
But I just don't want to be killed. And that's the difference. Like, I have no sense that when I'm in France that anyone's going to kill me because of my race, because they don't like me. They might take long to seat me at a restaurant or something, but it's not a life or death situation as it is in the United States. And that's the difference.
Well, I'm glad that you are putting out this data. And I'm absorbing it. I don't know what to do with a lot of it, but
the only thing you do with it is to examine yourself and work on that. If everyone did that, then the problem's fixed.
See, this is, can I say, I think what I do love is like, we were saying, look, we're all just going to be honest with each other right now.
Yes.
And I love that. I love that invitation. I love it. And I would like to make a couple of observations that I've noticed in these recent difficult conversations I have been having with people of color. And it flies in the face of everything I've been taught by my teachers because, you know, Ram Dass, one of my teachers, he said, there is a revolution of love happening right now. And, you know, and Michael Beckwith, my wife and I were just listening to this beautiful sermon Michael Beckwith was giving on, you know, impossible. Look, break down the word. It means I'm possible. It's possible. Mm-hmm. They said the wall couldn't come down. There's so many times in history where they've said it's impossible. But one of the things that I've noticed in chatting with Black people about this very uncomfortable, beyond uncomfortable thing, what are you going to say, an uncomfortable genocide? I'm sorry, is the genocide inconveniencing you? Is that y'all have a kind of optimism that I don't share. It is...
How could we not?
Oh, wow.
How could we not? Like I tell people, like, somehow my ancestors made it through the Middle Passage. They made it through 450 years of slavery. They made it through Reconstruction. They made it through civil rights for me to be sitting here today. How could I not be optimistic?
Right.
Like, I don't, you know, it's impossible. Like, it's not in my DNA not to be optimistic. Like, what you had to believe to be enslaved and make a family of your own and have traditions and to pass those down and to get married and have babies under those conditions, you had to be a craft. Like, your craft was optimism to be able to do that.
Wow.
Like, I don't have a right not to be optimistic. That's how I feel about it.
Are we allowed to be optimistic right now? Are white people allowed?
Everyone should be optimistic. I need people to be optimistic, because if you aren't, if it's all doom and gloom, then why would you do the work?
Right.
But here, like, what's different now is that we're having these conversations. And like I tell people now, because I've unpacked my own internalized racism and anti-Blackness, that I'm no longer willing to sacrifice my dignity and my children's lives for your comfort. Mm. And so that means you're going to get it from me straight, because I can't afford to keep you comfortable anymore.
Right.
And that's the difference. And I think a lot of people have that collective sense of, this is the time. Like, I will not allow for my children to be having this conversation 25 years from now. And so whatever it is for you, it's not what we've experienced, and you're going to get over it and be fine with it, but we got to just give it to you straight. Like, we're not keeping anyone comfortable anymore.
Right. Well, there is an insidious thing there too, isn't it? Because it can seem like the work is done. See, this is one of the things. When I was coming up, there were periods in my life where I would think, the work is, America.
We've come so far.
Oh yeah, we were fucked up back then. Back then, can you believe how fucked up those genocidal, psychotic, conquering white people were? But now, we've done it. I probably thought, yeah. And then you're like, let's watch Cops. Get me a beer. Let's sit down and watch Cops, which is essentially the running. It's a game show where Black people get chased down by people with guns. And I'm sure you know this.
And it's normalized.
Well, I listened to an NPR story on it. So once the people have been arrested and their adrenaline's pumping, the crew of Cops would go to them and get them to sign the releases, and they would not tell them they were with Cops. So they thought they were just signing stuff that Cops wanted them to sign.
Yeah. I mean, but it's, again, you become desensitized. And so my fear is that people will become desensitized to seeing Black bodies dying on their screens if we continue to let it happen.
Right.
It's already normalized. Like, oh, okay, another one today. You know, it's normalized. Like, why aren't we all in a state of shock, trauma, and anger after watching someone be killed over an 8-minute period on our phones?
Right.
Because we're desensitized, all of us. It's like, oh, okay, another one. He's going to get indicted. He's going to get off. And then on to the next one. Like, I've lost count of the people. And that's where we're at. And so I think, you know, there's a part of people, there's so many issues and so many layers that people are overwhelmed about where to begin.
That's how I feel. And also there's this kind of lazy fatigue, a blurry fatigue that sets in. There's this just sense where you just feel like, well, this is where my pessimism comes in. And chatting with you is helping me, but there's still on very dark days, I think, well, maybe this is hell. Is this just hell? Are we just in a place where human sacrifice, you know, it's like, what, they're not putting them on Mayan pyramids and driving daggers into their hearts But what are they doing? They're making it so they go to the hospital and the doctor's like, you don't know your body like I do. I'm going to leave you in this little room here. And, you know, maybe
go home.
Let's roll the dice. You know what? You might die, but let's roll the dice. It's so insidious. This is to me where this is the part that's like, God, if it were pyramids, if they were wearing Klan outfits, if they were self-announced, if they all had Adolf Hitler mustaches, you know, at least then we could be like, fuck, this is Nazis. Now we're looking at this.
But it's slow and over time and everyone's comfortable and you have TVs and you have Netflix.
Yes.
And, you know, it's hard for a lot of people. Like I said, I was just saying, like, the amount of drama people had about having to stay in their house and like watch Netflix, like that was a sacrifice and a struggle.
Right.
You know, we're going to like topple structural racism overnight. Not going to happen.
Right.
There's a lot of sacrifice is going to have to go along with that. And when you lose things that you thought were your right, and it was actually a privilege that was afforded to you as a white person, it feels like you're being discriminated against.
Give me some examples of that.
So, you know, you think about jobs, for example, in most industries, unless even I was going to say hip hop, but even that, like the decision makers aren't people of color. Most industries, the people who hire and fire are non-Black people, non-people of color as well. And so if there was equity and all of a sudden, you know, the 15 people in leadership, you know, are all equal, then you're not necessarily going to be the person in charge.
Right.
You're not necessarily going to have like a leadership position. You're not going to be the only people on the board. And so if those things start getting taken away, it will feel like for many people, and they're used to those things being theirs, they'll feel like they're getting the short end of the stick. I'm being discriminated against because I'm white.
Damn right.
You know, because you're losing the benefits of privilege. And that for some people is going to feel like discrimination.
Oh God, you should hear. I mean, so many comics, white comics are like, just forget it. You can't get a job anymore unless you're Black.
Yeah. I mean, I was married to a comic for a long time.
I'm sorry.
So I know the, he's actually passed in 2018. Mm. But you know, even he would say, like, I know that a lot of things that I do and the gigs I get, Black comics aren't even at the table for this. Like, they're not going on HBO. Like, they're not going on this tour. Like, unless it's like the Black comedy tour. Like, they're just not at this table.
Right.
You know, and that's just what it is in this world. You know, so it's, you know, I feel bad for him because he would have so much material right now if he were alive to be able to be during this time. Like, I know it would have given him lots of material and would have made him really upset, but very happy to be able to speak on what's happening right now.
That wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't long ago at all.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, 43 years old. Yeah.
What was his name? Can you share his name?
Sean Rouse.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
What a world you're in.
I know.
2020.
A lot has happened. But even that, like, I think, you know, me and Sean, we met and we're both from Houston. So we met in Houston. And, you know, we came to LA years and years ago. He had a pilot and was working. And I would think about, like, when I would go to shows with him, just some of the, like, the blatant things are just like, are we serious? Like, it's in every industry. Like, no one is, you know, like, there is no one who can say that their industry or what they do or their community is free of this. Like, you see it in every turn.
So Sean Rouse, he was can I tell you a story about your husband?
I'm sure you have some probably really funny bad stories, but go ahead and tell
me. No, I have a great story about him.
Ex-husband. He's my ex-husband when he passed, but we have a beautiful child together who's 13 now.
Well, let me tell you about your ex-husband. He was brilliant as a comic.
Yes, he was.
And so I go on stage. This is when I was going through my, so embarrassing, my edgy. I would call it me trying to be edgy. Which is like, because it's so easy to trick yourself into thinking, like, if you're up there being edgy,
yeah,
and people aren't responding, it's like, you know, they just, it's too, It's too tough for them. When it's like, shut the fuck up. You're just not writing. You're not writing. It's not a joke. It's not a joke. And there's so many of us out there who make that mistake, and it's an embarrassment. But I'll fully admit that I did. I went through an Andy Kaufman phase too, equally embarrassing. That being said, I go on stage and I make some stupid joke about being molested as a child, which I was not, as far as I'm aware. It was a dumb, lazy joke. And something about trying to connect that to being a better artist or something. Mm-hmm. Awful, stupid, edgy joke. I get off stage and Sean gets on stage. He followed me and he's like, wow, Duncan said that makes you a better artist. It just really makes it so I can't sleep at night very well. Because I think he was abused.
He was sexually abused. And he was very open about it. So I'm not sharing anything that he didn't talk about all the time. And he was in his act a lot. By like a do-gooder in the neighborhood through the church who like helped all the parents and molested all their children, basically.
It led
to a lifelong addiction for Sean. Why he was my ex-husband.
That was a tough husband. Yeah. But that was, in comedy, I've had a few smackdowns that like helped me. And that was one of the great, because he knew I respected him as a comic. So, and he knew I was watching his set. And that was a good one for me. It really helped me in my writing. And I'm sorry that you lost him. And I'm sorry for all the people who lost him.
I know. He was very quick-witted and like, but I still have laughs about the things that we laughed about. And I tell everyone like a couple months before he died, he called me and was like, you know, being Sean and like, but not being Sean, apologized for how he was as a husband and told me that, you know, make sure our kid knows that I love him. And I kind of just like, Sean, stop, like, whatever, like, stop with your melodrama. You're fine. Like, you know, and for me, it's like, oh my God, I'm so glad we got to have that closure before he passed, because he passed like maybe 3 months after that phone call, you know, and obviously he felt it somewhere that this was happening for him. You know, but it's like, we get to have that and, you know, and I see many things that happen. Like, you know, you talk about like, did that happen to me for a reason? So many things happen for a reason. Like, you know, I was doing a project and I happened to like, go to this office and his manager, which is what brought us to LA, is like next door to the person I'm working with. And I was like, how in the world, like I'm a doula, like, but I'm in the office, like where this all happened, you know?
Yeah.
However many years ago with me and Sean, this is for a reason.
It's too much. It's too much. I think this is a good place. I didn't know we'd get here, but a way to wrap it up, because I have been around, you know, I've lost my mom and my dad. I've been around dying people and I've been around my son being born. And one of the things that was so wild to me was realizing that the energy in the room of a dying person is the same as the energy in the room of a person being born. And I wonder if you have felt that, or if you know what I'm talking about, that.
I know what you're feeling. I wasn't with him when he passed. What I can say is that I personally feel this need to like rebirth in either of the situations. Like when you're with someone who has a baby, you have this, just the preciousness of life.
Yes.
You get reminded of. And the same thing happens when someone dies. And so that feeling, that energy is something I feel in both ways, because losing him made me think, okay, he's 43 years old. We have this beautiful child. Like, you never know. Let me like we have to slow down. We have to like have these moments. We have to have these memories. We have to have that, you know, these traditions. In the same way when I had my son, my first, you know, I had my first at 28, my last at 38. When I had him, like I was trans, I became a new person. Like if I'm going to spend 1 minute away from this person, this child, like it has to be the most amazing thing. It has to be, you know, worth it for me to be able to do this. And so I think what you're talking about is just the energy that both of those experiences brings to people is the same thing, this idea of the preciousness of life.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. What a wonderful, wonderful thing to get to know you. And for our first conversation, which I hope will not be our last, to be through this podcast.
I'm glad to know that you knew Sean. That warms my heart.
Oh, I had a lot of, he was a really deeply respected in the comedy community.
Yeah, yeah.
He is so funny and such a sharp writer. And just
my son would love to hear that. So
if this comes out, well, that's all he's going to have to do is Google his dad, because that's,
it's like he watches his stuff to my chagrin.
I don't know if it's,
what can I do with his dad, you know?
Yeah, he was brilliant.
These are the stories that I hope that he will get to hear as he gets older about the craft and the type of artist that he was. Well, a lot of people who said they're a comic, honey, that doesn't really,
right?
Like, that doesn't have so much weight, because a lot of people can say that they don't actually do comedy. Like, they might say funny things, but that's not the same thing as being a stand-up.
Right, I know what you mean. Sean was
in that world a lot more than any person who's not a comic needs to be in.
No, Sean would have, this is how I know if someone's a comic is I think, if there were some kind of actual apocalypse and if we were living in rubble, how long would it be before they figured out a way to build a stage and start telling jokes again? And that was Sean. Sean, he had a lot of challenges. He had a lot of reasons to stay home and not wait to do 10 minutes of material. And he
lived for it. Lived for it.
Yeah, he sure did. Well, he's lucky that y'all had a connection. He's lucky to have known you at all. And I think it's really wild to.
I'm lucky to have known him. I would have never be doing what I'm doing or have moved to LA if I hadn't met Sean.
Wow.
I could have easily been in Houston working a 9-to-5 and doing what you're supposed to do and collecting benefits and he allowed me to be confident and that's not what I wanted to do. And being around someone like him that was so free and just knew like he was going to do that. There was no plan B. It was just comedy.
That's right.
Allowed me to have that sense of freedom as well. So we were equally lucky.
How cool. Well, I feel like Sean popped into the podcast for a second. That was truly unexpected.
He's like, I'm going to be there.
Well, could you do me a favor and let people know where they can find you? I hope some folks listening are in LA and are looking for a doula, because wow, you are the real deal. And
you for saying that.
Thank you.
Well, all my pages are public, but on Facebook, I'm Brandy Jordan. My Instagram is Brandy Jordan Official, and that's how they can find me. Or my website is thecradlecompany.com. And I find people don't know how to spell cradle. So it's C-R-A-D-L-E is one thing I've learned in the past. The past 10 years is that people don't know how to spell cradle. So
cradle. How do people usually spell it? With a E-L?
C-R-A-D-E-L.
Okay. Or with a K makes it sound like
or two D's.
Really? Double D cradle. Well, there you go. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All the links y'all need to find Brandy are going to be at duncantrussell.com if you didn't write them down. And I really, really appreciate you sharing yourself with us. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Brandy Jordan, everybody. You can take her anti-racist parenting workshop. The link to find that will be at duncantrussell.com. A big thank you to all of our sponsors today. If you want the link to those sponsors or to the offer codes, that's at duncantrussell.com too. And a massive thank you to you for listening to the DTFH. We will be back next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.